The National Broadcasting Company presents a report to the nation by the Secretary of State, the Honorable James F. Burns. Mr. Burns will discuss the recent conference of foreign ministers in Paris. The Secretary returned from Paris on Saturday and tonight makes his first public statement on the meeting. And now, Secretary of State Burns.
I wish to talk with you about the meeting of the Council of Foreign Ministers at Paris. On that mission, I was accompanied by Senator Connolly, Chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and Senator Vandenberg, a Republican member of that committee. I cannot adequately express my appreciation of their wise counsel and loyal cooperation. Senator Connolly was exceedingly helpful, and Senator Vandenberg, by his wholehearted cooperation, let the world know that regardless of how much he and his party may disagree with the administration about domestic issues, in our relations with foreign governments, we have but one policy, the policy of the United States. Building the foundations of a people's peace in a war-shattered world is a long, hard process. A people's peace cannot be won by flashing diplomatic triumphs. It requires patience and firmness, tolerance and understanding. We must not try to impose our will on others, but we must make sure that others do not get the impression they can impose their will on us. The progress made towards peace at the Paris meeting of the Council was disappointingly small in light of the expectations we had when it was agreed at Moscow last December that the Council should resume the work which had been interrupted by our inability to agree at London in September. But the progress was infinitely greater than I expected when I suggested that the Council should meet in Paris preparatory to the prompt calling of a peace conference. We differed considerably on a number of fundamental points, but we did come to know what those fundamental points were and the varying weight the different ministers attached to those points. We found that there were three basic issues outstanding on the Italian treaty: reparations, the colonies, and the Italian-Yugoslav boundary, particularly as it concerns the Italian city of Trieste. In summarizing the significance of these basic issues, I shall deliberately seek to avoid intensifying the conflict in viewpoints. Our position on reparations is simple. To enable the Italian nation to live, we have already advanced, directly or indirectly, $900 million. We should prefer, in the interest of peace, to forget about reparations. But we are willing to agree to limited reparations, provided these do not deprive Italy of resources necessary to enable her to subsist without external assistance. If Italy requires help from others, she will look to us. And at Paris, we made it clear we are not going to advance millions of dollars to enable Italy to produce goods to be paid as reparations to any of our allies. The Soviet government has insisted on reparations for itself of $100 million. We have pointed out certain sources from which reparations can be taken, which would not seriously affect the Italian economy, and which would yield substantially the amount which the Soviets claim. But the Soviet government is unwilling to count what she will obtain from some of these sources as reparations. For example, she insists that some of the naval ships surrendered by Italy to the navies of the United States and Britain be shared with her. She declares the ships are war booty. War booty belongs to the nation capturing it. The Soviet Union has never shared with allied nations any war booty captured by her, but we are willing to give to her, in lieu of reparations, some of the naval ships surrendered to us. She demands the ships, but refuses to consider them as a substitute for reparations. She insists upon being paid out of current production. Well, we would have to finance the production. Therefore, I refuse to agree to the proposal. Differences regarding the colonies have been narrowed, but not resolved. The Soviet government receded from its claim for a trusteeship of Tripolitania first in favor of a joint Soviet-Italian trusteeship, and later in favor of an Italian trusteeship, as originally proposed by the French. Our position has always been that the colony should be placed under United Nations trusteeship, having as its objective the welfare of the inhabitants and their independence at the earliest practicable date. The trusteeship council should appoint a neutral administrator responsible to it, thus avoiding all possible rivalry between the powers. Libya and Eritrea should be granted independence in 10 years. It is open to question whether Italy is in an economic position to assume the responsibility of trusteeship and whether the return of colonies to Italy as trustee takes sufficiently into account the wishes of the inhabitants. For these reasons, it was with considerable reluctance that I indicated my willingness to yield to the French suggestion of an Italian trusteeship if that would bring about an agreement in the Council and if it were agreed that a definite date would be fixed for the independence of Libya and Eritrea. But the French government was unwilling to agree to a fixed date for independence. And the British felt that because of their promises during the war, they could not agree to an Italian trusteeship for territory occupied by the Senussi tribes. For security reasons, they also proposed a British trusteeship for Cyrenaica. When no agreement was reached, I again urged the American proposal for a United Nations trusteeship. It was my impression that agreement on reparations and the colonies, as well as on a host of other questions, would not be long delayed if only a solution of the Trieste problem could be found. The Soviet representative finally indicated that there would be no serious question on the cession of the Dodecanese Islands to Greece, but he refused to approve it until the other territorial dispositions could be agreed upon. The experts appointed to investigate the Italian-Yugoslav frontier did not differ as to the facts. But the Soviet representative differs from the other members of the Council as to the conclusions to be drawn from the facts. It is his position that Venezia Giulia must be treated as an inseparable whole, and that so treated, the claim of Yugoslavia to the area is superior to that of Italy. The other representatives believe that wise statesmanship, as well as the explicit decision taken by the Council at London, requires a boundary line which will in the main be an ethnic line, leaving a minimum of people under alien rule. It was wrong to give Italy the whole of Venezia Giulia after World War I. It would be equally wrong to give Yugoslavia the whole of Venezia Giulia now. It would transfer from Italy to Yugoslavia approximately 500,000 Italians. The British and French experts proposed ethnic lines more favorable to Yugoslavia than our own. In an effort to reach agreement, we stated we were willing to accept the British or the French line or any other ethnic line that could be justified upon the basis of the London decision. The American delegation then suggested a plebiscite for the area between the line proposed by the United States and the line proposed by the Soviet Union. But the Soviet delegation would not consider a plebiscite, except for the whole Venezia Giulia area. All of us are agreed that Yugoslavia and the countries of Central Europe which have for years used the port of Trieste shall have free access to Trieste, at which there shall be a free port, under international control. But we will continue to appeal to the Soviet government and the Yugoslav government not to press for a boundary line, which will needlessly violate ethnic principles and will breed trouble in the future. Agreement on the Balkan treaties is blocked principally by the inability of the Council to agree upon the economic clauses. Agreement on these provisions may have been delayed as part of a bargaining process. Although so far the Soviet government has stood out against the inclusion in the treaties of any provision which would promise freedom of commerce on the Danube, the gateway to Central Europe. It is regrettable that our outstanding differences on the treaties could not have been adjusted at our recent meeting in Paris. A short recess to allow a calm re-examination of our respective positions should expedite agreement when we reconvene. But when a world short of goods and short of food is crying for the return of conditions of peace, we cannot indefinitely delay the making of peace and the withdrawal of troops from the occupied areas. The four Allied governments cannot indefinitely delay the making of peace with countries which they have long ceased to fight, simply because they cannot agree among themselves on peace terms. The Council of Foreign Ministers was formed to facilitate and not to obstruct the making of peace. It was for that reason that the American delegation proposed that the Council at its next meeting on June the 15th should conclude as far as possible its work on the proposed drafts, but that the date for the peace conference should be definitely fixed for July 1 or July 15, and that invitations should be issued at once. It was our view that the Council had taken sufficient time to try to narrow their differences, and at this stage, with the principal issues defined, we should not deny to our other war partners their right to participate. The making of peace is not the exclusive prerogative of any four governments. Soviet delegation insisted that invitations for the conference could not be sent until we had reconvened and agreed on all fundamental questions. Unanimous agreement was necessary, and we were forced, therefore, to recess without agreement for the actual calling of the peace conference. While the American delegation, when the Council reconvenes, will make every effort to reach agreement on fundamental questions, it will renew its demand for the calling of a peace conference on July the 1st or July 15th. If we cannot have a peace conference until the four nations agree on every subject deemed fundamental by any one of them, that will give to one member of the Council the power to stop all efforts towards peace. It would be better for the Council to submit to the peace conference a single draft of each treaty, and set forth in this draft both the matters on which agreement has been reached and those on which agreement has not been reached. This will permit free discussion in the peace conference by all the nations that did the fighting, and world opinion will then point the way to a final settlement. If the peace conference is not called this summer, the United States will feel obliged to request the General Assembly of the United Nations under Article 14 of the Charter to make recommendations with respect to the peace settlement. But I confidently expect a peace conference to be called this summer. The situation which we will face in the coming months will be a test not only of others, but of ourselves. There are now and there will be in the future many occasions which might impel us to say, as we did after the last war, that much as we would like to cooperate in the restoration of Europe, cooperation as a practical matter is impossible without the sacrifice of our principles, and that we must be content to cultivate and defend our own hemisphere. But we must not forget that if we fail to cooperate in a peace which is indivisible, we may again find that we will have to cooperate in a war which is worldwide. Whether we like it or not, we live in one world. I am unwilling to admit that we cannot cooperate without sacrifice of our principles. If we are going to play our part, we must take the offensive for peace, just as we took the offensive for war. The victories of peace, like those of war, require sacrifice not of principle, but for principle. They require faith in ourselves and in our ideas. They require initiative, resourcefulness, and unrelenting effort. There is no iron curtain that the aggregate sentiments of mankind cannot penetrate. The American delegation at Paris did not hesitate to start the offensive for peace. Security is a concern of every nation. But the effort of one nation to increase its security may threaten the security of other nations and may cause them, in turn, to try to increase their own security. The quest for security may lead to less rather than more security in this world. It is in truth extremely difficult to know to what extent the action of any nation may be ascribed to its quest for security or to its desire to expand. But some so-called security moves on the diplomatic checkerboard have not contributed to a general sense of security. Many of these moves are said to originate in the fear of the revival of German military might. On our way to Potsdam last summer, President Truman and I discussed this situation, and we agreed that it should be fixed American policy to disarm Germany and to keep her disarmed, to do what we can to prevent a struggle between the powers for the control of Germany, which might give Germany the chance to divide and conquer. Those principles were stated in the Potsdam Agreement. President Truman and I thought at that time that the policy of disarming Germany and keeping Germany disarmed for a definite period of years should become a part of a solemn treaty between the principal Allied powers. Our policy should be to prevent war and not to wait until aggression gets out of hand. It was not a new thought. It had been foreshadowed in the Moscow Declaration of 1943. Others had discussed it, but no one more forcefully than Senator Vandenberg in a speech in the Senate in January 1945. At the London meeting of the Council of Foreign Ministers in September, when the Soviet Foreign Secretary seemed greatly concerned about the Soviet security requirements in the Balkans, I suggested a 25-year four-power treaty to keep Germany disarmed as a means of preventing any real threat to Soviet security. I explained that we contemplated a similar joint guarantee of the disarmament of Japan. I again proposed such a treaty in a talk with Generalissimo Stalin on December 24th, while I was in Moscow. The Generalissimo said that if the United States made such a proposal, he would wholeheartedly support it. Later, I spoke to Mr. Bevan, who advised me that he personally was most sympathetic to the suggestion. In February, I sent a working draft of the proposed treaty for German disarmament to the Soviet, British, and the French governments, and the proposed treaty for Japanese disarmament to the Soviet, British, and Chinese governments. I invited their suggestions as to the drafts. I was informed by Mr. Bevan and Mr. Beadow that they favored the proposal in principle, but would have a few suggestions to make. I did not hear from Mr. Molotov. Just before the Paris meeting, I advised the ministers I would like to discuss the proposal at Paris. The Soviet minister agreed to discuss it informally, but stated without specification that there were serious objections to the draft. At Paris, the Soviet representative stated he first wanted to know if Germany was being disarmed as contemplated by the Potsdam Agreement, and he feared the treaty might delay immediate disarmament. I pointed out that our proposal could not fairly be so construed, that it did not lessen the obligation to disarm Germany now, but provided machinery to keep Germany disarmed. To remove any question as to our purpose, I asked General Clay to request the Allied Control Council to appoint representatives with power to go into every zone and to make a report as to the disarmament of Germany. Later, the Soviet representative stated that when Generalissimo Stalin agreed with me to support the treaty, I did not have a draft of it. He said, too, that as it could not become effective until after a German treaty was signed, that consideration of it could be delayed. It is our sincere hope that after the Soviet Union studies our proposal and comes to appreciate our earnest desire to see Germany disarmed and kept disarmed, the Soviet Union will support it wholeheartedly. While the making of the German peace settlement may take some time, we took the initiative at Paris to propose the immediate appointment of special deputies to prepare a peace settlement which could be considered at a general Allied conference, the date of which should be fixed by the Council at its next session. While there is no German government yet which could accept the settlement, agreement among the Allies on the nature of the settlement is necessary to enable the Allies to know the goal towards which the Allied occupation and administration should be directed and the kind of German government which should be created to accept the settlement. I have also asked that the special deputies on Germany be instructed to report on several pressing problems, including boundary and economic questions. We cannot, for example, continue to carry out the German reparation program if Germany is not to be administered as an economic unit, as was agreed upon at Potsdam. Whatever boundaries are agreed upon for Germany, she must be able to subsist without external assistance. We are not going to subsidize Germany to enable her to pay reparations to other nations. I regret that the Soviet representative was not prepared to act upon my proposal for the appointment of special deputies without further study. But I shall renew the proposal when the Council reconvenes. Important as the German questions are, and eager as we are to press for their speedy solution, we cannot and must not delay the peace settlements with other countries. At Potsdam, it was agreed that the start should be made with Italy, Bulgaria, Hungary, Romania, and Finland. While Germany must remain under occupation for some time, we cannot fail to do our part to rid the rest of Europe of the burden of the forces of occupation. There can be no recovery in Europe until we do. It is particularly important that we press forward vigorously with the Austrian treaty. The Moscow Declaration on Austria contemplated that Austria should be regarded more as a liberated than as a satellite country. It was agreed at Potsdam that no reparations would be taken from her. She was one of the first countries in Central Europe to have free elections following the liberation. The continuance of foreign troops in Austria is an undue burden on her economy. In February, we asked that the Austrian treaty be prepared along with other treaties for satellite states. At Paris, I insisted upon its preparation, but the Soviet representative declined to discuss the Austrian treaty or to say when he would consider it. The making of peace with Austria is essential to the restoration of anything like conditions of peace in Europe. As long as there is no peace with Austria and foreign troops remain on her soil, military communication lines will continue to be maintained in Romania, Hungary, and possibly Italy. If peace could be made with Austria concurrently with the treaties now under consideration, there would be no necessity or excuse for a single soldier on foreign soil in Europe, with the exception of Germany and a line of communication through Poland. European states would have a chance to live and to breathe. It is American policy to press unremittingly for the conclusion of peace settlements, to make possible the withdrawal of troops from countries where they do not belong and where they impose unjustified economic and social difficulties upon the people. And even without waiting for the conclusion of peace treaties, it is American policy to press for the reduction of occupation troops in all countries. Our policy of continuing to press for the return of conditions of peace, without regard to the making of formal peace treaties, finally yielded some constructive results in the case of Italy. For months we have been urging the revision of the Italian armistice so as to restore virtually complete sovereignty to Italy, except in the colonies and in the controversial Venezia Giulia area. At Paris, this revision was agreed to. While the absence of a peace treaty still handicaps Italy in her effort to rebuild her broken economic and political life, the revised armistice gives the Italian government the largest possible freedom that can be given to it without a formal peace treaty. Our problems are serious, but I am not discouraged. Our offensive to secure peace has only begun. We are determined to work for political and economic peace in Europe, in the Near East, and in the rest of the world. We shall work for it in the peace conferences, and we shall work for it in the councils of the United Nations. The objective of our offensive is not territory or reparations for the United States. The objective is peace. Not a peace founded upon vengeance or greed, but a just peace, the only peace that can endure.
You have heard a report on the recent conference of foreign ministers in Paris by the Honorable James F. Burns, the Secretary of State. Mr. Burns spoke to you from his office in the State Department in Washington.